Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's just coming up on 3 o'clock, as a matter of fact. It's 3:05 right now. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon, and we have quite an interesting show. Students at UAS have been preparing a bunch of plays, and they will begin their performances this weekend. Boston Christopher will come in from Perseverance Theater to tell us about that. Greg Fisk and Sally Schlichting will be here. They're the members of the Capital City Marketing Co-op who are trying to put a co-op together, co-op marketing, a market, grocery store in downtown Juneau. Haven House, Cara Nelson will be in here, and the Friends of Recycle will be represented by Margot Knuth. Weather forecast looks like Wednesday might be a fairly nice day. Today we got rain, highs around 56. Tonight that rain's going to taper off late in the evening, and then Wednesday we're looking at mostly cloudy.
This is National Native News. I'm Jacqueline Estes, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Santa Clara Pueblo is receiving an $11 million grant from the Federal Emergency and Management Agency. The money will be used to remove debris and repair infrastructure damaged in a 2011 wildfire and subsequent floods. President Obama has signed legislation designed to boost Native American home ownership on tribal lands. Wyoming Public Radio's Tristan Autone has more.
The HEARTH Act, which stands for Helping Expedite and Advance Responsible Tribal Home Ownership, will allow tribal governments to approve leases on Indian land directly instead of waiting for the Bureau of Indian Affairs to approve said leases. The BIA process can take anywhere from 6 months to 2 years. Patrick Goggles is executive director for Northern Arapaho Tribal Housing on the Wind River Reservation. He says there are at least 20 Arapaho tribal members who have been waiting to negotiate land with the BIA in order to build homes, and possibly more waiting.
Because the home site leasing process has taken that long, and to get that in place prior to actually going to a loan program for a loan guarantee has often been highly frustrating for tribal members, hence the reason you don't see a lot of members engaged in homeownership activity.
Goggles says reducing wait times for lease approval will help tribal members on Wind River get better lease terms through federal agencies like the Veterans Administration, HUD, or Rural Development. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
Today, we hear part two in a five-part series on climate change and Alaskan natives. As ocean temperatures rise, fish and marine toxins normally seen in southern regions will move north. As Johanna Urich reports, Kodiak area Alaskan natives noticed more than 10 years ago that paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, was on the rise.
It was happening more often in places it hadn't before, and even in the winter when shellfish used to be safe. It wasn't just a little tingling in the mouth, either. Clams seemed more toxic. More people were getting sick. A Kodiak elder asked Bruce Wright, a biologist, for answers, but he didn't have any.
It's real quiet, and all the other elders are looking at him, and he goes, "For a scientist, you sure don't know very much, do you?" So I promised him I'd try.
The state only tests commercially grown shellfish. A decade later, he was working down the coast for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands in a region where people relied on clams and some had died eating toxic ones. He and Ray Rolon with the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program tested clams throughout the state for a year. They trained people from the southern tip of Alaska to the islands on the Russian side of the Aleutian chain and north to the Pribilof Islands in the Bering Sea to prepare samples and put the word out on PSP, more commonly known as red tide. One of those trained was Desiree Roll, an Aleut in King Cove.
Prior to this project, it was like Russian roulette. We would wait for our neighbors to go eat the clams, and then if they were good, we'd go get our clams. Somebody had to be first.
That testing program resulted in the first and only statewide baseline on PSP in Alaska. But it did not answer most of the questions asked by that Kodiak native more than a decade ago about why there seemed to be more problems with toxic clams.
Is there evidence that is climate related? The problem that we have is that we don't have enough data.
Ray Rolon with the Marine Advisory Program says with no data on what Alaska's shellfish was like in the past, it's hard to say if toxic levels are changing and why. I'm Johanna Urich.
During this week, on August 4th, 2003, Blackfeet and Gros Ventre writer and poet James Welch passed away at his home in Missoula, Montana. Welch is considered a leader of the Native American Renaissance, writing about the complexities of Native American life in books such as Fool's Crow and Indian Lawyer. Among other honors, he received an American Book Award, an Emmy for a documentary on the Battle of Little Bighorn, and the French Knight of the Order of Arts and Letters. Welch was 62. For National Native News, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Just coming up on 6 minutes after 3. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Let's take a quick look at that weather forecast just so we've got this all clear. For the rest of the day, we've got rain and the highs around 56. Southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour are going to kind of circle that rain around and blow it out of here tonight, so it goes down to a chance of rain tonight. And then the lows tonight will be around 50. Southeast winds will blow around 10 miles per hour with that. And Wednesday, we have mostly cloudy with, get this, a slight chance of rain showers, which is, you know, that's hopeful language from the weather folks. Anyway, the highs up around 60, north winds 5 miles per hour. So those will shift to the south in the afternoon, and then mostly cloudy on Wednesday night, chance of rain. So still not rain. Chance of rain, and then Thursday the rain's back. Rain is likely on Thursday. Highs up around 58. Thursday night rain, lows around 51. And Friday rain likely with the highs around 60. So looks like Wednesday may be the day to think about an outside activity or something like that without too deep of boots on for that. So my first guests are going to be very busy starting Friday night. And in the studio with me are three people who are involved in the STAR program. I think that stands for, Summer Theater Arts Rendezvous, which is a kind of a cooperative venture between Perseverance Theater and the University of Alaska Southeast, and it's a chance for young folks to get involved in drama. So you're going to do three plays, starting Friday night with the Pirates of Penzance, and Hannah Nell is here. She's in the show. Hannah, mm-hmm. Tell us what we're going to see.
Well, we're going to see a bunch of things, like we're going to see pirates, we're going to see romance, we're going to see fighting, and a whole bunch of comedy.
So what's your role?
I'm a pirate.
I should have known from the iPad. I missed it when you walked in. There it is, right there. One hooked hand and the iPad. Uh-huh. Just gave it away. When you're not being a pirate in Penzance, are you like a student somewhere around here?
Yeah, I go to now Floyd Dryden.
To Dryden, okay. Yeah. And you start up, I think, in what, 3 weeks?
Yeah.
So you've been how long you been doing the STAR thing? How long did this program last?
Well, this is my first year actually. Mm-hmm.
So I think it starts, let's see, what was the start date of this? It was sometime in June, wasn't it?
Started July. It's a five-week program.
It's a five-week program, yes. So it runs through STAR. The voice you just heard is Barb Meyer, who is here accompanying the pirate, and also another lovely young lady, Avery Coakley, who is going to be on stage on Saturday beginning, and then two more performances after that in Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
So, what part are you playing?
I play Tybalt.
Oh,
I am the cousin to Juliet.
Ah, okay. And how are you finding this play?
I'm really enjoying it. I have a liking to Shakespeare, so it's really exciting for
me. Had you read it before you
I read it when I was a freshman.
Okay. And you are now?
And I am now a senior.
A senior at?
At Thunder Mountain.
At Thunder Mountain, okay. All right. Are you doing drama there as well?
Yes. I am involved in the drama debate forensics team, and I do the plays there, too.
Doing debate as well?
I am not very good at debate.
Okay.
I've done it. Not very good.
So do you have another event at the forensics meets?
We usually do either acting exercises, or sometimes we're given prompts that we have to debate about.
Okay. So tell us for those of us that can't just bring the whole of Shakespeare's script right back into our heads, what's the relationship between Tybalt and what's his action in the play?
He pretty much hates Romeo with a passion because Romeo is a Montague, and Tybalt is the Capulet who is, he's like the king of the Capulets. He wants everybody to know that the Capulets are the best, and the Montagues should not be acknowledged at all. And every time he sees a Montague, he has to fight them because that's just the way he is.
So was Shakespeare, was the language tough? Are you, you're doing it in Shakespearean language, it's not
it.
One of the updated versions. Okay. Was it tough to get?
I've always really liked Shakespeare because I started taking Japanese a few years ago, and I like to translate things, and it was fun to be able to read the script and have it read to me and be able to analyze it in my head to figure out what they're saying. So for me, it wasn't particularly difficult, but I know that when I was younger, it didn't make too much sense.
So it comes with maturity, I guess.
Maybe. Probably.
Would you like to play more Shakespeare?
Yes, definitely.
And do you have a play in mind?
I would really like to do the whole of Midsummer Night's Dream, because I did play as Pyramus and Bottom the Weaver in sections in Much Ado About Will last year. But I'd really like to do the whole thing, even if I'm not Bottom the Weaver. I really like Midsummer Night's Dream. It's my favorite Shakespeare.
And did you, a couple, 3 years ago, they did it, I think.
Yeah, I saw Aaron Elmore and
Theater in the Rough.
Yeah,
it was Theater in the Rough that did it, yeah.
That was spectacular.
Yeah. Yeah, they do a wonderful job with Shakespeare. So, back to Pirates and Penzance. Hannah, how big is the cast? How many people are?
I can't really count it right now, but it's kind of really big. There's like a whole bunch of people there. There's cops, pirates, daughters, main cast.
And you're singing in this.
It's a musical.
Right. So, was the music in this thing moves real fast? I mean, there's a lot of words in those songs.
Yeah, especially in like. I am the very model of a modern major general.
Ah, yes. One of our very favorites.
Wow, that is a tongue twister.
And you did that very well. Okay. So, Barb, there's a third play involved in this, and it was written by Ishmael Hope.
Yes.
And it's called The Bailer in the Back of the Boat.
Bailer at the Back of the Boat.
I think it's a retelling of a Clinkett. A myth story?
It's a weaving together of several stories important in the Tlingit culture, and it's told through storytelling. It's sort of written for young people to honor the elders and give thanks for the stories that have been passed down, and to give thanks they retell the stories to show the audience and the elders this is what we now understand about these stories that are important to us.
Uh-huh.
It's really beautifully written, and George Hawley has been directing. He's a songwriter and has written a couple of his original songs that are inserted throughout also. He's also in the show, so it's a pretty magical piece, but with lots of Tlingit embedded in it.
Is it? So is this small company or is it large?
It's a very small cast.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But so I'm going to point out that we have Shakespeare going on, Gilbert and Sullivan language that comes at a clip, and then Tlingit and our kids, there are 43 total in the program this summer, are really mastering the challenges.
Yeah, in 5 weeks.
And that includes 1 week of performance.
Yeah, so.
So with really kind of 3.5 weeks of rehearsal, they are on their feet, ready to go, with swords in hand, singing, dancing, fighting, jumping, leaping.
Romeo and Juliet get daggers. Pirates get the sword.
And bottles of poison. I mean,
we get our poison, too. That's true.
Yeah.
I think that makes up for it.
Okay.
They're all really exciting shows, though.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a wonderful week. So the schedule, do you have it with you? Can you go through it?
I do. So we open this Friday night with Pirates of Penzance at 7:30. And then this Saturday, it's the opening of Romeo and Juliet at 2 o'clock. And then Bailer at the Back of the Boat plays this Saturday night at 7:30. And on Sunday this weekend also, then we go back to Pirates.
Okay.
So, and they kind of rotate. It's all on the website at Perseverance Theater. But you can the three shows have three performances. And if someone wants to see a specific show, if they went to the Perseverance Theater website, they could see the exact time and show time.
Yeah, is there a charge? For, are they?
It's $5 for youth and $10 for adults.
Per play.
Okay. There's a pass, $25 okay. for three shows.
Okay.
To see the whole all three if you'd like, and everything is sold at the door. Tickets and the passes are
okay.
sold at the door.
Okay, so not the usual suspects around town.
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. Good. Okay, so it's the STAR program.
Uh-huh.
Let's do that tongue twister name of that thing again. I'm trying to get it to roll up here on my screen,
good.
And
so
I can't get
summer
it.
Summer Art Rendezvous.
Summer Theater
Arts
Rendezvous.
Arts Rendezvous. Okay,
yes.
good. All right.
Yeah.
And with us to tell us about these things have been Hannah Nell, Avery Coakley, and Barb Meyer. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for undertaking to play difficult parts in great plays and for bringing us the entertainment to watch you do it.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 31st of July, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet and novelist Kim Adonizio, born Washington, D.C., 1954, who said, "Poetry is not a means to an end, but a continuing engagement with being alive." It's the birthday of the woman Teddy Roosevelt called the most dangerous woman in America, Mary Harris Jones, Mother Jones, born to a tenant farmer in Cork, Ireland, 1837. Her family fled the potato famine when she was just 10, settled in Toronto. She trained to be a teacher, took a job in Memphis, Tennessee, where on the eve of the Civil War, she married a union foundry worker and she started a family. But then after the war, a yellow fever epidemic swept through the city. Her husband, all four of her children, died. She was 30 years old. She moved to Chicago. She built a successful dressmaking business only to lose everything in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. And that's when she got involved in the city's labor movement. She worked leading labor organizers. She co-founded the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, the Wobblies, traveled the country wherever there was a labor struggle. Mother Jones said, "I asked a man in prison once how he happened to be there, and he said he had stolen a pair of shoes. I said if he had stolen a railroad, he would be a U.S. senator." She was a passionate critic of child labor, and she organized a children's march from Philadelphia to the home of Theodore Roosevelt in Oyster Bay, New York, with banners reading, "We want to go to school and not the mines." At the age of 88, she published a first-person account of her time in the labor movement called The Autobiography of Mother Jones. She died at the age of 93. She is buried at a miners' cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois. Mother Jones, who said, "Whatever the fight, don't be ladylike." It's the birthday of Primo Levi, born in Turin, Italy, 1919. He grew up when Mussolini was in power in Italy. He joined the movement for young fascists while he was going to college, got a degree in industrial chemistry. But he couldn't get a job because he was Jewish. So he joined the partisan resistance. His group was taken prisoner by the Germans. They were transported to Auschwitz. When the camp was liberated by the Red Army almost a year later, Primo Levi was one of only 20 of 650 Italian Jews who had survived. He went to work back in Italy at a paint factory, but he worked on a book about his experience entitled Survival at Auschwitz. It came out in this country in 1958. He wrote more poetry, more memoirs, including The Periodic Table, which traced his family history using the chart of elements. Primo Levi, who was concerned with people's ability to remain passive in the face of injustice. Here's a poem for today by Ramon Montaigne, Unification. The Mississippi at its mouth joins the Gulf of Mexico. The west wind mixes with the south, high pressure with the low. Nothing in nature stands apart, all things rendezvous. I'd like to mingle with you. Intermingled, intertwined, this is what I have in mind. I just feel a sudden urge to merge. The compound that is chlorophyll formed as the light increases makes every little flower thrill with photosynthesis. The morning glory mingles with the honeysuckle vine. Come wrap your little tendrils around mine. I've been lonely as a cloud, drifting miserable and proud, lonely as a limestone butte, handsome, noble, destitute. But I need you, I confess. Let's coalesce. Unification by Ramon Montaigne, used by permission of the poet, here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Nick Vedder, written by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 21 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for a Juno afternoon. My next two guests have been working hard for the last several months. They claim that they have accomplished 2.5 years of work in about 4 months, I think, or something like that. Anyway, Greg Fisk and Sally Schlichting are here. They're members of the board of directors for the newly formed Capital City Marketing Co-op, which is exploring the possibility of bringing co-op food grocery-type thing to downtown Juneau. Hi, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks.
So tell us what you've been doing.
You want to go first?
Well, yeah.
Somebody should.
It's been a pretty intense few months. When it was announced that A&P was closing. We heard a few rumors about this, that, or the other store that wasn't interested in opening down there. And it occurred to me one day, this may be something that citizens have to take into their own hands. And I'd had a little exposure to co-ops, and I actually sent an email to Sally. I said, this town might need a co-op if we're going to have local ownership of our downtown grocery store. And she immediately and impetuously put it out on the downtown neighborhood listserv, and we got a big response. So
what is a co-op precisely?
Well, a co-op is a business that's owned by its members, as simple as that. And there are lots and lots of them in this country that people tend not to think about. Actually, Sally brought some statistics on this.
Yeah, there's about 30,000 co-ops nationwide and across all sectors. So there's quite a variety. There's seafood co-ops and there's electrical co-ops. And there are some big businesses that you're probably familiar with, like Ocean Spray and Land O'Lakes and Sunkist and Florida's Natural Orange Juice. And then you have a lot of smaller co-ops, and you have grocery store co-ops, which, of course, is the model we're seeking.
Are there other co-ops in Alaska?
There's one that's just about to open the doors, I think, in Fairbanks. They're very close. And they had kind of the same situation as we did. There was no grocery store in downtown Fairbanks. So a group's been working on that for several years, and they're just about to open. I think they're going to be opening this fall. So that's pretty encouraging. And I met with some of those people at a co-op conference back in June, and they've put in a tremendous amount of work, and looks like they've got their act together to do it.
And there's some other examples of co-ops here in Juneau, too, that people might not be aware of, like the True Value Hardware Store is a cooperative, and True North Federal Credit Union, and then there's a Seafood
Producers Co-op in Sitka is successful co-op. It's been operating here. It's a producers co-op, and they've been operating since 1941, and they're one of the most successful seafood companies in southeast Alaska.
And, of course, everybody's familiar with REI as well. It's another co-op.
Yeah, but when people think of co-op grocery stores, they usually think of the place the only thing they have is organic fruits and vegetables, and there's people who have to serve a certain amount of time in order to get their membership paid off and that sort of thing. Is that what you're contemplating for Juneau?
No, it's not, but that is a model, certainly, and there are a lot of smaller co-ops like that. There are a lot of co-ops that require members to do a certain amount of work at the co-op, but on the other end of the scale, there are there are ones that are just very, very sort of ordinary business-like that you wouldn't know they're co-ops when you walk into them unless you read the fine print. A good example is the very successful chain in Seattle called PCC, which is a Puget Consumer Cooperative. They're just known as PCC. They have 9 stores. First and foremost, they're just really great grocery stores. But they are run by their members. The members vote for the board of directors and things like that. So there's all levels and manner of co-op formation, and our primary focus is simply to have a really good grocery store. We're going to try to avoid food politics. We're not into that. We recognize we have a diverse community downtown to serve, and diverse ethnically and economically. And we're going to have, if we get this together, we're going to have conventional groceries. We'll certainly have natural and organics, but just about any food store has that these days. So.
My wife and I were on the road a couple years ago, and we went through Boise, Idaho, and we were picking up, some food for the car and like that. And we stopped into this market that was alongside the road, and at the end of our shopping expedition, when we had everything in the cart and everything, the lady said to us, member or non-member? And we had not known at all the time that we were shopping for food that we were in the middle of a food co-op. Yeah. But when we checked out, they had a different set of prices for folks. It was kind of like the Safeway card that you show and get the discount at the
Yeah. I co-ops do, like Greg was saying, there's a lot of different models. There are some co-ops where it's you have to work, and there are others like PCC where nobody works, and then there are others where you have members, you have members who work, and you have non-members, and each of those tiers get different discounts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of flexibility in how you design it.
Yeah. So you're in the process of designing it. Is that where is the process right now?
Well, we had a first informational meeting about, I think it was on May 8th, and we got a lot of interest. So some of us just decided, well, we've got to take the bull by the horns here and just get organized. So we ended up saying, all right, who's really interested? And we're a core group of us that decided we'll just push this ahead. So we had a 5-member steering committee, which has now transformed itself since we're legally incorporated. That steering committee is now the interim board of directors. We are incorporated. We've got a business license. We've got a bank account.
We got bylaws.
Mm-hmm. We took stuff from bylaws from all over the country to tailor to our needs and looked at. It's one of the great things about co-ops. They all share information with one another. Mm-hmm. So we got great help. And like I said, our bylaws call for a standard business model that avoids a lot of complexity. We're trying to keep it simple now. At some point in time when we've got a full membership, people may want to change that and do this or that differently.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing right now is we're holding our founding membership drive, and we're looking for founding members to contribute money. At this point, it's it's a $250 membership and an additional $250 if they can contribute as a founding member. And then when we have enough capital from that founding membership that we've raised, then we'll have the first membership meeting. And at that point, the founding members will be voting in the first meeting to elect board members and decide on other things, maybe revisions to the bylaws, maybe it's a revision to the membership fee, whatever. So at that point, then it becomes that real membership-driven organization.
The news stories this morning said that you're looking at a marketing study.
Yeah, that's a very, very important first step. A marketing study basically tells you what, it's based on your demographics in the area, and it will basically say what kind of store and how big, we can support. So, it somewhat depends on what we have input into that study, but it'll be done by a national professional group called Cooperative Marketing Services. They do stuff for cooperatives all across the country, but also for conventional grocery, too. So they're very used to examining metropolitan areas to see what the market potential is. That will give us a good indication of what size store we can support, and that's a very key element that we need going forward, because without that kind of detailed data and market study, you can't really talk seriously to bankers and others who are going to need to eventually develop this.
It just makes sense.
when you started your effort, it was triggered, I gather, by the announced closure of the A&P market downtown. How much of your effort is tied to acquiring that space?
Well, we've certainly been focused on that, but we're well aware that the owners of the Foodland complex are looking for somebody to move in there, probably a conventional grocer, because timing for a co-op is longer. So we initially saw ourselves as the backup option, where if they didn't find somebody, that we would be as ready as we could be
to step in. It's probable at this point in time that they have somebody that they're going to announce fairly soon. But we're not sure of that yet, so we're pressing ahead. And there certainly has developed, I'd say, in amongst the supporters for our effort, there are quite a few people who would just like to see a co-op, period, and they're saying, well, maybe there's another location. We haven't made a decision on what to do about that yet.
Yeah.
Well, eventually you're going to have to make that decision, I guess. So the marketing study is really the next step.
Yes.
Do you have an idea when that's going to start?
Well, we have a proposal in hand from Cooperative Marketing Services, and we know how much it costs. It's about roughly $12,000 we budgeted for the marketing study.
Okay.
We do have now enough cash on hand to do the marketing study. From the time that we give them the go-ahead, it's about 4 to 5 weeks before they're done with the study.
Yeah, I think we expect results maybe towards the end of September, probably, something like that. So.
And then if that's favorable, then you have this board meeting and essentially form the organization or decide that it's not a viable undertaking. And,
yeah, that's correct. And right. I think, too, you know, if while the marketing study is going on and, you know, another operator comes into Foodland, you know, that's going to be built into the marketing study. She'll look at that. So
if someone is interested in working with you or joining you or something like that, how would they contact, how would they go about doing that?
They could contact us at capitalcitymarketjuno@gmail.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Well, thank you so much for bringing us this information and for your hard work today.
Thank you very much.
And we'll stay tuned and see how it comes out. Thanks.
All right. Thanks.
This is Bird Note. Although not a first-rate vocalist, the bird making this groan-like call is one of the most recognizable to the eye. These sounds belong to the tufted puffin. Puffins are icons of the seabird world. With clown-like faces and huge, multicolored bills, they stand upright on sea cliffs along the northern oceans. Tufted puffins nest on islands and rough coastlines, from the Channel Islands of Southern California, across the North Pacific to Siberia. If you see a puffin on the East Coast, it will be the Atlantic puffin. But you'll have to go a long way north, because they nest on islands in the Gulf of Maine and beyond. A flexible hinge at the back of its jaw allows a puffin to hold a whole row of fish crosswise in its bill, and it can catch still more, even as it swims swiftly underwater. And that's not all. The puffin uses its massive bill to dig nest burrows. The tufted puffin's burrow might be up to 6 feet deep. You too can dig deeper. Whether you missed an episode of Bird Note or want to listen again, you'll find all previous episodes on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
About 26 minutes before 4 o'clock, weather forecast looking like maybe Wednesday's going to be the day of a lesser chance of rain. So it's not they're not saying to us that it's not going to rain, but they're saying that it kind of slacks off on Wednesday a little bit. So my next guest is representing an organization called the Friends of Recycling. Margot Knuth is here, and tell me about this upcoming meeting and some of the other activities that the Friends of Recycling are involved in.
Thank you for this opportunity.
You bet.
We're meeting on Thursday, 6:30 to 8 o'clock p.m. at the downtown Juneau Public Library. And the purpose for the meeting, Friends of Recycling has been around in Juneau for well over 20 years. Mm. And we've become fairly topic and project specific, and we've worked especially hard to get other people, such as the City and Borough of Juneau, to take over recycling projects, and we've enjoyed doing being less active on the ground for the last 10 or 15 years now, and so we sort of rise and come back into activity when there's a special project. And the new special project is unwanted catalogs and phone books. So we've been asked to do a partnership with the City and Borough of Juneau, which is entering into a contract with an organization called Catalog Choice. And, Catalog Choice. And it makes it easy for people to indicate what catalogs and what phone books they do not want to be receiving anymore. So even though we're friends of recycling, before you get to the point of the benefits of recycling, there are more benefits from reducing. And if we can start slowing down the amount of junk mail that's going out, if we can try to turn that tide of just hundreds of tons of unwanted paper before it ever gets to the point of should I recycle it or not, that would be significant.
Margo, I don't want to take away from your current program, but I'm curious about something, and that is we just had a huge shift in our recycling capabilities in Juneau, in the sense that before here about a month ago, you had to sort everything and take it over in the back of your pickup truck or the back of your car and deposit it in the thing. And now if you subscribe to the service, you get the blue-topped container in front of your house, and you can throw all of the recyclables into that, and it goes down. Has your organization been monitoring that program to look at its effectiveness?
We are very interested in the effectiveness of it, and we would frankly like more information than we've been able to garner thus far. And we would very much welcome an opportunity to learn from Arrow Refuse what sort of response they're getting and whether Waste Management and Arrow Refuse are tracking the tonnage that they're bringing in. Statistics is an area that people are always very curious about, and they're a bit difficult to come by. And we're hoping that at some point maybe we could do even a radio program jointly with Waste Management. And if they could provide information at that program, we could maybe have some people calling in with questions. But we're hoping that that might be available in the future. Right now, we know that a lot of people are participating this way. There are people who are still taking their own recyclables to the center when it's open, which is now on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. And some people are doing both. Glass is an item that you cannot recycle in the curbside program. So, and the glass is a commodity that can be reused at the landfill. They use it for the roadways that they need to make to what I refer to as Mount Trashmore. I'm not sure.
It's a good name for it. So to what extent does your organization, or you're a group of volunteers, do you have any official backing or any official capacity? You have an agreement about you've been asked to work with the borough, but are you, I guess I'm asking, is there any muscle behind your organization?
The muscle of interested citizens and the collective group. We don't have official status. We're a nonprofit corporation with a fairly long mailing and email list, but not so many active month-to-month participants. We're basically grassroots, and when something comes up that we're able to make a contribution, then people get together and take on the project. We started with glass recycling. We were crushing glass out at DOT's, 5 mile, 6 mile parking lot there. And the city and borough took over the glass crusher. So that was the first thing. And then we started working on different commodities. And we just try to see what's going on in the rest of the United States. Right now, another pet topic of mine is trying to find a way for people to recycle their small batteries without having to wait in line at hazmat for an hour or whatever, and the consumption of gasoline to drive and participate in that event. So I'm looking for some way that I just was down south, and some businesses now have these plastic cylinders in the store where you could just drop transistor radio batteries, A's, B's, not B's, we don't have B's, A's, C's, and D's. Do you ever wonder about that? Whatever happened to the B battery?
Tubes. Tubes went away, so B batteries were no longer needed.
There it is. But you know, we're just a collection of individuals who are paying attention to what's happening elsewhere, and when we see something that strikes a passion, a fancy, then we come together and just using communication and outreach have managed to be, I think, very effective.
I think Home Depot accepts fluorescent bulbs and CFCs. They've
correct.
Got those the tube that you were talking about. They've got something similar to that up there. And I know I've taken some long fluorescents out of my garage shop lights up there, and they accepted those as well. I didn't think they'd take a four-footer, but they did.
Yeah, no, that's very commendable.
Yeah, yeah. So this other program, is there like an agency that is or a company that is recycling the batteries from the tubes that you're talking about that go into the store?
Well, it would be a way of getting them to a program like Hazmat, but in sufficient quantities so that you don't have to have a bunch of individuals bringing their little baggie of batteries and instead make it worthwhile and try to work with the economy of scale there.
Yeah, so Hazmat is now requiring that the tops of the batteries be taped.
That's news to me.
Yeah, you can't turn batteries in at the events anymore unless you take at least masking tape and tape over the tops of the batteries. One pole of the battery has to be taped. So that could throw a real monkey wrench into the tube plan.
Well, that's good for us to know. And
this was just announced, I think, three events ago that they started requiring that all batteries be taped.
Okay.
So anyway.
I suppose there has to be a safety element there that required them to come up with this.
It would be interesting to know exactly why they do this, because the individual battery, the most I know that anyone would be throwing away would be 12 volts, and I'm not sure that I see how that would cause a hazard, but it's their business.
Yeah.
I'm not a hazmat guy. Anyway, the meeting is on Thursday, 6:30 to 8 p.m., and its topic is how to stop unwanted catalogs and phone books from coming into the area. Will there be other agenda items at that meeting?
I expect there'll be a discussion about the curbside recycling and what we know about how that's going. But for the most part, this is to find people who are willing to help Friends of Recycling in publishing and getting the word out about catalog choice. And the city will be adding a web page where people can sign up for the opting out of catalogs and phone books. And so our part of it will be helping get the word out to the community of Juneau when this comes online and what the benefits are, and encouraging more households to sign up.
You said you had an extensive mailing list. How big is it?
Our mailing list is several hundred. We have stopped asking for contributions from the community because we don't actually have financial needs at this point. But the last time we did a mailing, I'm guessing somewhere around 350 people were on our mailing list, and then our email list is about somewhere about 100 people.
So if someone wants to be on your email list, how would they do that?
they would, we
I,
have...
I took you by surprise,
yes,
I'm sorry.
Yes, you did. Linda Deakins is our secretary and keeper of the list, and we have a phone number, which I am not remembering right now, but if people leave their name on the on our phone message, we can call them back and get their get them on the list. I'm thinking that it's 789. Oh, I'm not going to give a possibly incorrect number. Never, that would not do.
It's 780-4212, according to a quick web scan there. So, anyway,
you're very efficient. That's terrific.
I just happened to have the keyboard right here next to me, and I could do it. Okay, meeting Thursday night, 6:30 to 8 p.m. Downtown Library. Friends of Recycling. Contact them at 780-4212 if you want to be on the mailing list or the email list, and good luck with getting the program going as the borough has kind of given you the go-ahead to help out with it.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Little appropriate music here.
Then gather up your garbage and sort, sort, sort. Put the cardboard in here. That's box number one. Don't get tossed, 'cause we're not done. Clear glass goes in box number two. Keep on sorting, 'cause we're not through. Dark glass goes in box number three. Box number four is the last. You'll see, for the green glass is all that's left. And it recycles just like the rest. Go tell your neighbor, go tell a friend. Before you toss that garbage, try to use it again. You try it. Go tell your neighbor, go tell a friend. Before you toss that garbage, try to use it again. Now separate your paper in three different piles. You know recycling is the latest style. Rainbow colors have their own box. You can mix them up like you do your socks. All the white paper that you can find has its own place in the recycle line. Newspapers go in their very own stack. Tie them in a bundle or a neat little pack. When you recycle paper, you're saving trees. Now try that chance along with me. Go tell your neighbor, go tell a friend. Before you toss that garbage, try to use it again. Go tell your neighbor, go tell a friend. Before you toss that garbage, try to use it again. Aluminum foil costs a lot to make, and it takes forever to biodegrade. So use it over and over and over each day. And when it's spent, don't throw it away. Make an aluminum foil ball, and your recycle basket can catch it all. Top it off with aluminum cans. Not much goes in your garbage can. And speaking of cans that food comes in, save that soup or tuna fish tin. Take it to the recycle yard. Recycling's fun and not very hard. Go tell your neighbor, go tell a friend. Before you toss that garbage, try to use it again.
Before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is Kara Nelson, and our Kara Nelson, and Kara is with an organization called Haven House. Kara, I haven't heard a great deal about Haven House. Can you give us an idea of what the organization is and what you're doing?
Well, Haven House is a faith-based organization that will be providing transitional living situation for women exiting the prison system, whether it be the jail or the halfway house, up to a year of living and
support of some kind.
So, yeah.
How many is Haven House like a local organization? Is it a national organization? Or?
It's a local organization. Right now, we don't actually have a housing facility at the moment. That's uh-huh. what we're getting closer to that right now. So we're basically in the financially getting motivated for fundraising events and different grants and things like that.
Cara, how many people are involved in the Haven House structure?
Well, right now, this is actually a vision of a 30-year prisoner volunteer named Ellen Campbell. It's a need that she has seen over the years working here in Lemon Creek and other prisons. And we have a board of different people in the community that just have a real passion for implementing this here in Southeast Alaska. We don't have a transitional home of this kind here in the Southeast.
For women? Or
yeah, for women.
Do we have one for men?
No, I don't believe so.
So, and the focus on women prisoners is because of Ellen's dream?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, the next real, I guess, need that Haven House is looking for is some place to put would it be a group home or would there be several residents in the facility at a time? Or
to start out, we're looking at housing probably 6 women.
Oh.
I mean, like I said, depending on the structural situation that we find ourselves in.
Right.
We have received some financial grants from the state, which is exciting. So, everything's moving forward. We're now looking for a full-time executive director to kind of put these things into place and get it, hopefully in 2013 we'll be opening our doors to at least 6 women, maybe mm-hmm. more later. We'll see how it goes, but definitely get it going here. So,
are there criteria that you plan to apply to accept women into the facility once it's established?
Well, it is a faith-based organization. The women will not have to make a statement of faith just to agree to be involved in the different fellowship that goes on in the home, but we'll also be working with other community programs such as Love Inc. and different mentoring programs and, of course, the other substance abuse and mental health and mm-hmm. these kind of things. So basically just a real strong, sincere desire to want to change and take that hand that's there to help and go with it,
Right. You're faith-based. Are you associated with a particular church or no?
No.
Okay.
I mean,
so it's more like Love Inc., which is across the
yes.
board from.
Yeah.
I think all of the churches in Juneau are involved in Love Inc.
It's an awesome organization.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just getting to that identity of women who might feel like. Yeah, the things that they have done, maybe they can't get through that. So, Christ-based. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's not any particular domination or anything.
I think the hardest problem for people who are coming out of incarceration is in many cases it's almost as though they've never learned how to live in society. And it seems to me that the one of the major roles that a halfway house placement or something like this, a support group that follows, can play is basically to teach the process of being a member of society. Because
sure.
Many of the people who run afoul of the law My impression is that they just never learned how to live in the society, and,
right.
and it's a mystery to them.
Right.
Years ago, I interviewed a man who was in the halfway house here in Juneau, and he said that he'd been in prison more than he'd been out. He was an elderly man, too. He was in his 60s. And he said part of the problem was that he could do okay for a while, but then he just didn't know how to do things. And so he wouldn't pay his light bill, and he'd get in trouble financially, and then he had to do something in order to get money. And, yes, there was a way, and he knew it quite well. So,
exactly.
Anyway, that's...
Yeah.
I think those are the kinds of skills that most people take totally for granted, but for someone who's on the edge of the system, it can be quite a mystery.
Right.
So what would your role be, do you think, once the house is established?
My role, I mean, at the moment, I am on the board. I'm also a recovering drug addict. I've been through the prison systems. I've been through the halfway houses. You know, so I obviously have a real passion to share my freedom with other people, and I just have that intimate knowledge of of where I was then and where I am now, and it's really exciting for me to know that, you know, I can be a member of this community, you know, and set my goal, my levels, you know, where I never thought was possible, so... That's my part here. I've been there, done that.
Another thing that I've observed as well is that there's a level of trust that people who've been on the inside don't trust people who've always lived on the outside.
For sure.
And so you bring yourself into a situation where your past and your background becomes a real asset to the situation. So, but there's some bravery involved in stepping forward and doing this as well. your options are always different. Well, Haven House, I guess one of my questions would be, what is it that you need from our listeners?
Well, just look forward to hearing about different fundraising events that will be going on. There's been letters sent out to all the churches, so if you're involved in a church, there's usually a liaison with Love Inc. And be out there, support our community.
Well, wonderful. Kara Nelson, thank you so much for turning us on to the concept of Haven House, and I wish you good luck.
Thanks for having me.
Well, on tomorrow's Juneau Afternoon, Jeff will be talking with Ariel Rolfe and Brandon Howard. They have an upcoming public art display. We're coming up on First Friday. Darren Snyder will be here with news about this month's sustainability camp. A bunch of kids are going off into the woods to look at how to sustain on foods and other things that are available in the wild in Southeast Alaska. Artists involved in water states, that'll open Friday at the Franklin Street Gallery. And Dana White and James Marcus will come in to highlight tomorrow night's workshop on knotweed. You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators in the Valley and Auk Bay. You can get a better signal of KTOO on K276 AF. Tune your radio to 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we come in loud and clear at 101.7. Gustavus hears us at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoona at 91.9. The Gustavus translator is K21 AM. In Excursion and Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on K210 AS at 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable. Juneau, we're on digital channel 871. KRNN and KXLL, our sister stations, are on 872 and 873. And we're also streaming continuously online at www.ktoo.org.